How is everybody today? Warming up a little?
Trying to.
It was crazy weather, but we do live in Ohio, right? So today I'm going to talk to you a little about a group of men who served for the state of Ohio during the American Civil War. These men were free blacks for the most part, who before the Civil War in Ohio did not receive equal treatment. They did not have equal civil rights. Most of them, at best, had a second-class status. And when the war broke out, a number of these men sought to enlist in 1861, and they were denied this opportunity. The state of Ohio had in place a militia law, that forbade black men from serving. So that was used initially to keep them out of the Ohio troops that were then sent on to Lincoln to support the Union effort. This all changed after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And when the final proclamation was released on January 1, 1863, it provided for the enlistment of former slaves into the U.S. Army. Black leaders, white abolitionists in the North, fought for the right for these free men to also join. And it was Governor Andrew in Massachusetts that had the first success at creating a black regiment, the 54th Massachusetts. And if you've seen the movie Glory, that's the story of that regiment. And many Ohio men went and joined the 54th because they were denied access to join in Ohio. The 55th Massachusetts, the sister regiment to the 54th, had more Ohioans than men from any other state. So it was kind of an Ohio regiment. It wasn't until Governor Todd found out that these states that were raising black regiments could count those men towards their draft quotas that he and the state of Ohio allowed black men to join. And so what happened is we'll get two black regiments from Ohio, the 5th United States Colored Troops and the 27th. The 5th actually, when they start enlisting, they were given the name 127th OVI. So if you've studied anything about the Civil War, these were state regiments that were then turned over to the federal government. And so New York had the first New York infantry, Massachusetts had the first, and on and on and on. So Ohio would follow the same naming policy. But what happened is many white Northerners were uncomfortable with this. They believed that they should be not only segregated by regiment, but not identified with the state. And so what we get is the creation of a federal bureau of colored troops. And so the 127th will change its name to the 5th USCT, United States Colored Troops. That was the proper name of them. And so even though they came from Ohio and the governor turned them over, they had a federal designation. They would be paid by the federal government. The second regiment was the 27th United States Colored Troops. So approximately 6,000 African-American men from Ohio will serve in the United States Colored Troops. In total, black males composed over, or just about 10% of the whole Union Army. About 180,000 men would serve, so Ohio had proportionate to the state's population of black males. And once the war was over, most people understood this act of allowing black men to be in the Union Army, despite being segregated into all black regiments, that this meant something. From the Civil War period and before in the United States, even in late colonial era, there is a very clear understanding that military service to one's country or state meant manhood and citizenship. That was the highest recognition of a man and of a citizen, was to serve his nation or his state. And so once Lincoln opened that door, and once people like Governor Todd from Ohio allowed men to serve from their state, almost everybody understood what this meant. like letting the genie out of the bottle. You are not going to be able to neatly ignore that this had happened, especially when 10% of the Union forces, the Union Army that was victorious in this war, they had helped. They had been part of this. So when we talk about these men coming home from service, when they are mustered out, we're going to have approximately 5,000-6,000 of these men start to come home in the summer of 1865. The two regiments that I've specified here, the 5th and the 27th, are mustered out in late September. The war ended when? What month did the Civil War end?
I'm going to take a shot.
Take a shot.
February.
April 1865, but it's a good shot. April 1865, and I just said the men were coming back home until September. They served in occupational duty for a while. The argument that the Union Army used, and most Northern citizens agreed upon, was that white soldiers had, for the most part, been serving for 4 years, whereas the United States Colored Troops was not formed until 1863. Therefore, the white soldiers should get to go home first, and this was the larger argument. So the men in the 27th USET and the 5th USET would be in occupational duty in the Carolinas for the most part. So when they come home in September, most of the parades, most of the celebratory actions that the war was over was long done. That happened in April and May. Most people had already started to move on as much as possible. They were ready to move on after 4 deadly years of war. And so when we have these men coming to Columbus to receive their final muster out, there is going to be little fanfare. When these men left Columbus to go to their homes all over the state, we did have some local groups welcome them home. For example, we had a group of individuals that wanted to celebrate the return of veterans in the Pickaway County area. There were several counties from Ross, Highland County, that area of the state. But when they held their celebration, the 5th had returned home, but the 27th had not. They still were finalizing their last few days in Columbus. And so men that lived in those counties were welcomed home to a picnic and a parade and celebration by their local families. But the 27th returned to those counties too late to be welcomed other than by their private families. In October, as these men were leaving Columbus, the State House decided maybe the men of the 27th deserve some kind of recognition. And so they had their official mustering out at Camp Chase, but their more ceremonial muster out was held right in front of the State House in downtown Columbus. Few people came. Families could not travel to see this if they lived in far parts of the state. But what one Cincinnati newspaper noted quite gleefully, it was a Democratic newspaper, was that none of the white Republican officials who had argued for black men in service were present to bid them thank you and adieu. That instead, there was very few people there, and they went home with little fanfare. So it's not looking really good for these men when they come back to Ohio. The other issue when they come back in 1865, the mass number of these men, is they're pretty physically wrecked, right? We do know that the black troops suffered from discrimination during the Civil War. Many of them received less or inferior food, inferior weapons. They had to perform more physical duty, fatigue duty, than most white soldiers, although there were many white regiments that spent a great deal of time doing that. So this is going to make it more difficult for them to maintain their health, more so than what we already know is problematic for almost all Civil War soldiers, right? More Civil War soldiers died of disease than from military food, more work, and so that means those diseases are going to spread even more rapidly and hit them even more strongly than the others. Now, we want to be really careful. There's a book that's out, and it's a very well-done book about the health and the medical treatment of black troops during the Civil War. But it is one that looks at all 180,000 as a kind of generic group, or a monolithic group. And when we look at northern soldiers, those that came from the free states in the north, particularly I know from the 5th and the 27th, that they actually didn't suffer the same degrees of illness as what she's reporting for all of the United States colored troops. It is true they suffered a higher rate than white Ohioans, but they also suffered a much less number of fatalities and injuries because they're used less in battle. And so black troops from Ohio had similar casualty rates and sickness rates. So if you look at the 27th, for example, they had two doctors, the regiment had two doctors, the soldiers. The head physician was a man named Francis Weld. He was from Boston. He was in his early 20s. And he had just graduated from Harvard Medical School. Now that right there should send some dings for some of us, but that is how it happened in the mid-19th century. So he's inexperienced, but he is as educated as one could be in the medical field at the time. The assistant regiment was Herman Niedermeyer from Cincinnati, and he was in his 40s, so he had much more experience, but it's clear that the men did not think highly of him. They would seek to go anywhere but to see Herman Niedermeyer. They did not like him. They thought he treated everybody with the same patent medicine, and so they would seek other care. Weld ended up serving not with the regiment. He was kind of pulled out, and he would serve with the brigade at the brigade hospital, oftentimes for white officers of United States colored troops. He did perform exorbitant amount of surgeries after the Battle of the Crater on July 30th of 1864. But other than that, he didn't have a lot of contact with the men. So this regiment had medical care. They had access to medical care. But like most doctors in the mid-19th century, it may not have been what they had hoped they would receive. So they come home, and some of them have been injured by battle. Some are exhausted, malnourished. They have been overworked. The number one problem for these men, as was the case for almost all Civil War soldiers, was dysentery. Clean water, clean food, adequate latrines just did not exist for most of these men throughout the war. And this is going to be a problem that plagues these men the rest of their lives. So in a physical sense, when they come home from mustering out in 1865, many of these men are in physically poor shape. They're not being treated to parades like some of the white soldiers were. And yet, there is that issue that they were soldiers and they had served in the United States Army. And that promised these men much more that outweighed what was happening at that moment. For example, at that time, the 13th Amendment had already been through Congress. It was seeking ratification. And so those that had fought to end slavery could take pride that they had participated in bringing down this institution. So when these men went to their homes finally, they're very anxious to get back to life with their families, seeking possibly to get married, looking for employment opportunities. Many were interested in buying land. And this is going to be something that for many of them, this was the first time they might have the opportunity. Some of those men, when they mustered out in October of 1865 from Columbus, from Camp Chase, left there with a significant amount of money. Okay, so in the Civil War, it was really hard to get your pay on a schedule. It was very difficult to pay men. The state of Ohio had a program where the regimental officers could collect pay and send it home, and so the money was actually at the county waiting for you. So some of the men, there was a year or two of pay. There were bounties that were held until they came. So some of these men were going to go home with $300 or $400 Now, for some of us, we know that doesn't even begin to pay for our books every semester. But remember, in 1865, you can buy property with that. You can buy good property in Ohio. So they leave again. They're not very well, maybe. They're not being planned for. But there's this change that might occur. And so those first few years after the Civil War, Ohio is somewhat of a testing ground for these men, what's going to happen. Well, if you've studied your U.S. history, you know that something is going to happen. We're going to have three amendments passed that are going to have a huge impact on African Americans in Ohio. In addition to the 13th Amendment that ended slavery, look at the 14th Amendment. Does anybody remember what that does? That's all right. It grants citizenship. And so not only were ex-slaves citizens, but so were free blacks in Ohio who had been denied those rights before the war. So they had fought for something. They had, in addition to the significant issue of ending slavery, they had received citizenship for themselves and their families. How about the 15th Amendment, ratified in 1869?
Voting.
This was the voting amendment. It's a confusing amendment, and I wish I had time to talk more about it, but nonetheless, in the initial passage, the belief was that black men were going to be able to vote. Okay? Now, you don't want to say, but we know what happened in the next couple decades. You have to remember, in 1869, what this meant to these men in Ohio, these veterans. Right? These changes were coming true. Not only had they been granted citizenship, which entitled them to equal treatment under the law, but they also were granted voting rights. But as I mentioned before, and it's important to note, Ohio is an area we can see a great deal of testing, of conflict over these amendments. So I'd like to share with you, in 1867, although Ohio became the seventh state in the nation to ratify the 14th Amendment, in 1868, they rescinded their ratification. What is happening is there are many Democrats in the state of Ohio that are unhappy with the Republican rule and this change that's occurring in relation to their black citizens in the state. And so they get back into, they take control of the state legislature for a short time. So they rescind this. Okay. Now, in a big picture, it doesn't matter because enough states ratified it, we know it becomes part of the Constitution. But Ohio, in this kind of ceremonial act, says we are not going to approve of this citizenship amendment. Does anybody have an idea when Ohio voted to accept the 14th Amendment? Just a guess. Just throw a number out. Unless you've heard the story before, you will not guess.
1940.
Pardon me?
1940. Later. 60.
72.
Pardon me?
72.
Wow. Oh my God.
you're giving good dates, though, that right, they correspond with these changes and stuff. 2003. Oh, an intern at the State House discovered in some papers that they were putting together that there was not that end paper that said we ratified it. So the State House, the legislature in Ohio said, well, that's kind of embarrassing. And so they held, again, it didn't matter. In 2003, it was part of the Constitution, but it shows you the conflict in Ohio over this issue. Okay. Likewise, Ohio refused to ratify the 15th Amendment until it became clear that the nation would have enough to ratify it. And then they said, okay, well, we'll just jump on board, even though we don't want to. So it's ratified. It's added to the Constitution. But in April of 1870, some men in Pickaway County went to vote, and local Democrats kept them from the polls. And so these men, about 140 of these men, petitioned the federal government. And many of these men were veterans from the 5th and the 27th. And they wrote to John Sherman and to John Bingham. One is a federal senator, and one was a federal House of Representatives. And they said, hey, there's this thing on the Constitution that said we can vote, and the Pickaway local people are not letting us vote. What are you going to do about it? And John Sherman presents this to Congress, and it becomes part of the evidence that will convince Ulysses S. Grant to sign into law the Enforcement Act that said blacks would be allowed to vote. So here were people that came back with the hope that there was change, and when faced with the reality that some white citizens were not going to take this willingly, they were ready to fight back. And they used that veteran status. They felt very strongly that veteran status should give them those rights. So, over the next decades, what you will see in the state of Ohio is a significant number of these veterans seeking out their rights as citizens that they will have access to success in a way that non-veterans did not. In other words, these black men and their families took advantage of the fact that they were veterans to find and to use and to gain what equal rights should have provided to all black citizens in the state of Ohio. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of that. This is a picture of a parade that some of the other men might have received. If you look, there are many people there, and it's very ceremonial. Should have showed you that a minute ago, but I missed that. These are two veterans' homes in Ohio. One is the state home in Sandusky. This was for any Ohio residents who were veterans. And then up above is a postcard from Dayton. This was the first federal soldier's home after the Civil War. So these were federal and state-funded institutions that were to take care of soldiers whose families could no longer take care of them. So as we mentioned, these men come home in 1865, somewhat broken. Some of them may have had amputations, still suffering from diarrhea in the years after the war. And if they did not have a wife, if the wife had died before, or they did not have the ability to have family care, they could seek support in one of these institutions. Men from the 5th and the 27th lived in both of these at a rate equal to the percentage of the population in Ohio. So if I would give you just straight numbers, it would sound like very few black men took advantage of these opportunities. But when you look at the percentage of population, they equal the population in the state. And so in other words, the federal home and the state home are not keeping them out. They are taking advantage of this care that a white man who was not a veteran would not have had. Now, there is evidence there was some discrimination. At the Dayton home, black men, although they ate in the same dining hall, had to visit separate barbers. There was a barber that just cut the black veterans' hair. So the changes in the outside world, that growing discrimination and segregation that we see by the end of the 19th century in the United States, is clearly playing out at these institutions. And no, am I suggesting that they were free from it. But the men took advantage of their right to have access to care. And for those that were elderly or were physically impaired, this made a great deal of difference to the quality of life in the last years of their life, that they could have a hot meal, have some place to sleep, and have medical care available to them. The way that these men and men that did not need to go to the federal or state homes were taken care of is the United States pension system. The pension system for Civil War veterans was started during the war, and it initially sent payments to families of men who died or were killed during the war. And the United States colored troops had equal access to this from the beginning. After the war ended, they realized that there were men going home that were too physically and mentally impaired. And so you could apply for a pension to help you pay for the cost of living and your medical care where before it was only the family of a deceased soldier that could get one. So this becomes quite a large federal bureaucracy system. By the end of the century, it's something like 70 or 80% of our national costs every year. Take care of these Civil War veterans. I think it's actually higher. I have the number written down. But this is an example of the pension certificate that was given to one of the men in the 27th United States Colored Troops. So the process was that you applied for a pension, you had to have witnesses, you had to have affidavits, and you had to have evidence that you had been hurt during the war, you were sick. So men that had severe dysentery, that was a legitimate reason to get a pension, because that kept you from working if you were weak, too weak. Once you received a pension, there was an amount that you were awarded every month, and then you had to keep up with annual physicals, and then if you became healthier over time, they could reduce or take away your pension, but if your health declined, then you could ask for an increase. And these men, starting as early as 1865, are applying for these, and they are lasting until they die. And if they had a wife or children under the age of 16, then they could apply to receive the husband father's pension. So we have a number of Ohioans that apply for these. Again, when I look at the 5th and the 27th, the number of USCT veterans who apply and receive pensions is very similar. The black men there are more black men that are turned down, but again, remember they have less battle experience. And so what we had was more wounded from battle are getting, so that throws the percentage off. If we take, though, a national view, and I step aside from researching Ohio, black veterans and their families did not receive equal treatment by the pension system. There is a great deal of evidence that they were not awarded at the same rate. One of the problems is that in the 19th century, for pensions, not only did you need affidavits that you had been in the war and you'd been hurt or you were sick, you had to have affidavits that you were an upstanding citizen at the time you were applying. There was a strong belief that your moral character was a legitimate reason to evaluate a candidate for a pension. Where this becomes a problem, not so much for Ohio veterans, because I can see they can come up with the evidence, but those men and women that were former slaves it was against the law, they were forbidden from having a civil marriage. And so those that did not seek to correct that after the war were deemed as living without marriage, right? They were living in sin, and they're classifying these people as not morally sound citizens. Again, in the state of Ohio, most of those men had been free before the war. They had certificates, although there are a significant number that I have read where they had at one time been slaves and may have married, and so they would get somebody to sign an affidavit, yes, this person was married, and that's was enough for the pension officials to agree to this. So that's one of the reasons there are less approved pensions for the United States Colored Troops. The other reason has to do with educational opportunities. This is a very complex system, and that you have to fill out form after form after form. You have to send in evidence of the marriage, of other information. And so again, when we look at the large number of all USCT, former slaves had been denied education. Therefore, many of them could not read and write. It was much more difficult to know what was available to them. And so, while again not denying that race played an issue, it does, there is also evidence that it wasn't the factor. I'll give you an example. A woman by the name of Nancy Scott, out of Chillicothe, Ohio. Her son died right after he returned home from the war. And she applied for a mother's pension. That was the other group that could get pensions. Mothers and fathers who could prove that their son in the war had been their sole source of support could get a pension. And so Nancy Scott was seeking a pension because her son, her only child, had died. And she's sending all of this information, and she could write. She and her son sent letters back and forth. As a matter of fact, I have over 27 of them. And she used these to prove what was going on, that he had died from the war. She used those letters as evidence that they're in the pension file. The problem is that in those letters was the fact that she was living with a man who was not her son's father and was not married. This does not mean she was an immoral woman. In the 19th century, many people had common law marriages. But in the application process, the pension evaluator said the Scots were, quote, free people, and that case should be treated exactly as though the claimant was a white woman, unquote. He said, you will treat this fairly, you'll come up with the evidence, and if the evidence is there, she will get a pension. But her letters prove that she was living with this man, because then he would write to the son, and they would talk about what they were all going to do when they got home. But in that case, it was the law, not race, that had a part. So you can find evidence of both. But again, if I come back to Ohio soldiers, very similar. So these Ohio men and their families have access to a monthly stipend that is going to help them live a better life than would have happened without any assistance. This is an example of another mother who writes, and she wants to get some assistance after her son has died. And what you can see is this is getting into the early 20th century. There are typewriters. I'm not saying that she has this. Pension attorneys flourished after the Civil War. And so you could go to a pension attorney, and then they would do all this paperwork for you. So the chances are this woman may or may not have been able to write is I would have to go back to the old pension files to see any other correspondence. But nonetheless, the federal government set a fee, and the most that a pension attorney could claim at one time is $10 for the whole case. And so for a woman that might get $20 or $30 a month, it was worth it to get that assistance to get the pension increased. These individuals from Ohio, the veterans and their families, not only sought pension attorneys, they also sought the help of their state representatives and congressmen, and numerous pension files have letters from Ohio state congressmen, legislators, senators who are writing the pension office saying, this man is from my district, and you will make sure he gets a pension. Now, in most cases, they were Republican candidates, so we know what they're doing, right? They're trying to get a vote. That's absolutely true. One of the soldiers even writes his congressman and said, hey, I voted for you last week. I need help. They knew the power that was there. But I have to tell you that there were Democrats who also were helping these men. So it wasn't just for that reason. Here's an example of what you would find at the back of every pension file that was approved. And every time these men went for a physical exam to keep their pensions current or to get an increase, they had to have a physical exam. I don't know how many of you are in here because of health and medical training, but you're the only group of people that write worse than I do. I cannot read the medical reports. They are unbelievable. But when you get to this part, you can see what's going on. So if you look on the, would be your left-hand side, there on the skull is the first wound where they have marked. And then over here, off the side of the lower hip, or the upper hip, lower hip, you see the second wound. And so they would mark where bullets went in. They would mark that for the pension adjusters who probably couldn't read the medical report. But the medical reports were quite thorough. Heart rate, they talked about the color of eyes, the color of tongue, weight, height. They evaluated at a health level, and they are pages long. So those that are interested in doing research, medical history, they're a wealth of information. I can't read them. And it got to the point as I start to, and I have several hundred pension files, I simply don't even try to copy those anymore because I just can't read them. And I don't do medical stuff, so it's okay for me. But they're a wealth of information. Some have photographs. One of the soldier or veterans from the 27th sent a photograph of his back a back view because of where the bullet had gone in, and that was his evidence. Look, I was shot, right? And I'm having trouble using my right arm because where it went in. So these men are able to have then this monthly stipend. Some of them, they'll use it at the veterans' home. Others use it for their own families. We're going to see a significant number of these soldiers participate in events like reunions after the Civil War. Again, a way to keep in the public eye that they had fought in the Civil War. And this was something that Civil War soldiers all over the United States are doing. But in this case, you see an example of one of the group of some of the black regiments that are getting together. In addition to having reunions, which are published in newspapers, right, and all of, if there was one going to be held, they're in local newspapers, and newspapers publish these as well as the white soldiers. Men are joining the Grand Army of the Republic. While not the same, similar to a VFW today, right? Veterans of Foreign Wars. So the Grand Army of the Republic was an organization for veterans of the Civil War, and it literally was a voting bloc by the end of the 19th century. They were determining elections or had the power to keep Republicans in office in many places because so many of these soldiers were voting. In Ohio, we see a very interesting situation. Again, if you go nationally, especially if you're talking about the South after the war, and there were Grand Army of the Republic posts in the South, you wouldn't see this. But in Ohio, there were three means for a black veteran. He could join an all-black GAR post. He could join an integrated post. And then a third there are three options. There wouldn't be allowed in a white regiment. I guess I said that a little backwards. But there were three options for all men. They had the ability to do two of them. There were a significant number of integrated posts in the state of Ohio. This man here, his name is Robert Penn. He was in the 5th USCT. He lived in Massillon, Ohio. He was also a pension attorney. It is fascinating to see that most of his clients were white soldiers. They did not go to the white warrior in town. He went to Robert Penn. Penn not only was a proud member of the GAR, he was one of the few black soldiers during the Civil War to win the Medal of Honor. He felt very strongly that black veterans should join the GAR and that they should join integrated posts. And when a group of men in Cleveland, Ohio, a group of black veterans, started to arrange to start their own chapter, he chastised them in the local newspapers, telling them that they were the ones that were creating segregation-like behavior. That if they really wanted to be in a GAR, shouldn't they be with their former soldiers? That they were brothers. Now, in his case, he will be the only head of a GAR post, black man to serve at the head of an integrated GAR post in the whole United States. This was a man that was exceptional in the sense to what he achieves after the war, but it led him to really question which opportunity you should take. Nonetheless, whether you were in an integrated post or a separate post, these men participated at the national encampments, and these were held in various states around the United States in the years after the war. One of the men from the 27th was nominated, Jeremiah Smith was nominated and served as chaplain. One of the encampments. So there were opportunities. It wasn't complete equality. But again, we know today what happens at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. We have that history that we know it doesn't turn out the way that it should have or might have. They don't know that yet. And so every time they're sending one of their veterans to the home, those pensions, being in a parade or being in the GAR, this was evidence that it was changing, at least for the veterans. Another example, and this one really fascinates me, and I'd like to do more work on it whenever that time comes. After the Civil War, local communities, of course, honored their dead in the years as they begin to leave this earth. More and more communities work to make some kind of focal point for veterans. And so many had in their cemeteries what were called soldier circles. Not new to the Civil War, but we see them really explode. All over Ohio, you can go into cemeteries and you'll see these soldier circles. And there, the Civil War veterans of the town are buried. They are easy to tell, not only because they are initially set up in a circle, but veterans could apply for government headstones, and these were free of cost. And those records are actually available now. You can search and see who was able to get them. Black veterans had equal access to these markers. By the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, even in Ohio, segregation had begun to really entrench itself in a way that we had a continuation of separate cemeteries or burial areas, except in soldier circles. The United States colored troops are buried with the white soldiers in the cemeteries. They're included in that brotherhood, if you will. And it goes just beyond the burial area. It goes beyond the fact that they could get the same headstone as the white soldiers. Funeral processions were held. These were a big deal in almost all communities after the Civil War, but I want to share two of them with you in Ohio. There was a man by the name of Qualls Tibbs in Lancaster, Ohio. He had been shot in the right shoulder, so he was a disabled veteran after the war. He walked around town with his GAR pin all the time. He was very proud, loved to show off his GAR pin. He went to reunions, he went to parades. He was a member of the Ben Butterfield GAR post in Lancaster, Ohio. His fifth son was named Philip Sheridan Tubbs, Tibbs. Anybody know who Philip Sheridan was? He was a cavalry general from Ohio. Underneath Grant and Sherman in popularity, but he was head of the Western armies at this time in the United States. So he was a prominent individual. When he died at 86 in October of 1922, soldiers and veterans gave him a special military burial. His GAR comrades walked with him to the cemetery, and an all-white squad from the American Legion fired a gun salute to honor him. This was in 1922. By then, they know things aren't going quite the right direction that they had hoped. Really interesting, 1948, the last Civil War veteran died in Akron, Ohio. And his name was Alvin Smith. He was 105. He was in the 27th United States Colored Troops. So 1948, what's just ended?
World War II.
So we've got military men and veterans everywhere in Ohio. They printed almost a half a page in the Akron Beacon Journal about this man's life. This is in 1948. And again, I have to point this out. One of the reasons why Truman seeks to work to desegregate the army is because right after World War II ended, there were two black veterans, and I apologize, I don't remember which southern state it was, but they were out with their wives, and they were in their uniforms, and they had a scuffle with a taxi driver, and as a result, four of them were lynched. They were in their uniforms. They just returned from fighting in World War II. President Truman's outraged by this. This is 1948. This is right at the same time. And the story tells of his early life. He had been a slave as a child. He ran away and he came to Ohio. He joined the 27th. But again, his burial, moving his casket to the cemetery, was the Masonic Lodge and members of the American Legion Post 272. So these men are getting a recognition as late as 1948 that many black majority of blacks did not have access to. Many whites would not have had that type of funeral service. And even though by 1948 it's clear that things have not turned out as they had hoped with those three amendments, those families continue to use that military service to push or to put in front of the public's eye that we had contributed and that they should receive some type of equal recognition. We can bring this much up to today. When we look around your community or if you travel, Civil War monuments and sculptures are part of our landscape. A Almost every community, at least small community, has one. And soldiers in the center of town. Some have been moved to cemeteries. And other than the prominent sculpture in Boston for Shaw, and he was the white officer, the 54th, and most of us know about this only because of the movie Glory, right? Other than that, there's very, very little sculpture and monuments that honor the United States Colored Troops, one-tenth of the war soldiers. One of the rare examples, this is in Oberlin, Ohio, and these original pieces, these stone tablets that are white in the middle, are created right after the Civil War, and they are putting all of Oberlin's veterans from any conflict on these tablets in the years after the Civil War, and they included every black soldier from Oberlin. In the, I think, 1980s, maybe early 1990s, these were in such disrepair they had been removed, and so people in Oberlin raised the money to put them in a new setting in Greenwood Cemetery, I believe it is. But they're Wright Park, but it's part of the cemetery. But this is part of not only their 21st century history, but they have this, they started this right after the Civil War. There is a monument in D.C. today, Washington, D.C., that honors the men, and it's near, not terribly close, but near Howard University, and it has the names of every one of the soldiers that they had records of that had fought, almost 180,000 men whose names are listed. But that's about it, okay? The actual recognition of these men still is far behind. And so while I've tried to show evidence of how hard they work to keep their service in front of others, the reality is that for many people, still today, unfortunately, they've not heard of the United States Colored Troops. I hope I've changed that for a few of you. And I think it's that for questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, I could keep going, but I know we're out of time.
Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Selby?
Hello, how are you?
Yes, go ahead.
You said that the Democrats in Ohio rescinded or threw out the 14th Amendment of 1868. So technically all the way up to 2003, we didn't have a 14th Amendment. Was there somewhere that it was straightened out? They thought that they had one?
So I kind of went quick there, and I apologize. It didn't matter what Ohio did or didn't do, because enough states had ratified it at the national level. It was added to the Constitution. So federal law recognized that these men and their families were soldiers, were citizens. That doesn't go away. It's very much more a nasty, in-your-face kind of act, right? It is a, we're in charge, we're going to do what we want in Ohio, but it had no grounding. The federal government amendment overrides what the state of Ohio says. So it was, and how it was undiscovered, you know, how for so long it went that someone didn't correct it. And Ohio didn't have to correct it. Again, it was already federal law. It was an amendment to the Constitution. It was more about local presence saying, we're in charge now. And they would not, Democrats would not remain in charge. Very soon, Republicans would regain. And if you remember, we had all of those Ohio presidents in there that helped the state in its direction at the time. That makes sense. Yes, sir.
I missed the very beginning of your presentation. You talked about the 5th and the 27th.
Yes, they're both Ohio recruited regiments.
Do those regiments exist even today, or have they been deactivated?
Yes. What happens is when the Civil War ended, the federal government said we no longer need 160-odd segregated black regiments anymore. The war's over. So they reduced to 4 infantry and 2 cavalry. So there were 6 black regiments for a couple years, and then that was reduced to, let me think if I can remember them, we had 2 infantry and 2 cavalry, 24th and 25th, U.S. infantry, which were all black, and I'm sorry the cavalry are not coming to my mind right now, 9th and 10th. 9th and mean, Theodore Roosevelt, the Black Cavalry were the ones that helped actually save his life. And they then, in the years immediately after World War II, actually when Korea started, it was still segregated, but we don't have the regiments yet, designation. And I'm not, I just don't know the 20th century designations. There were brigades or something. And so it's during the Korean War, Truman's gets through the act that desegregates. It's a presidential decree, and then it becomes law. So they go away before World War I. They just change their name, though. And then Korean War, we no longer have segregated regiments.
I just know that a lot of the units that exist in today's Ohio National Guard have long histories, and I was just curious if any of those units, you know, still exist today in some form or fashion, not segregated, of course, but...
Ohio still did not allow black men in their state militias and then the National Guard. Remember, they became federal designated once the United States Colored Troops, so Ohio didn't have to allow this. Two things come to mind, though. One of them's already left. But I can remember during the both times when we went into Iraq, and I can't tell you the numbers again. I just don't keep up on modern military terminology. But the Buffalo Soldiers, integrated units, obviously in the late 20th century, still identified themselves proudly as the Buffalo Soldiers. I can tell you, in that theme, there was this continued remembrance. But, oh, I know the other thing I wanted to tell you. Ironically, when you talk about the National Guard, the Stowe, Ohio Armory is named after Robert Pinn. And there's no direct line or connection to why, other than he was an Ohioan that won Medal of Honor. But he never had anything to do. Also, the University of Akron has a shooting range named after Robert Pitt. And I don't know if it was their National Guard, you know, the college groups, the ROTC. I think that's where that came from. So there is evidence that, yes,